This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. For years, ISU was knocking down dorms and moving students into off-campus apartments. So what happens to landlords like Andy Netzer if ISU builds more campus housing?
This is the world's simplest supply and demand economic loop. You just have the supply of students and the available off-campus beds. It's a one-to-one translation.
We'll report on the future of the student apartment business. And Mary Cullen has an update on the scope of domestic violence with an expert from Mid-Central Community Action. That after a GLT news update. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. As another school year looms, there have been some mixed signals about the health of the student apartment business in Normal. Landlords recently resolved a long-running dispute over their property taxes, saying they were too high, and some, but not all, objected to the new recycling ordinance, saying it'll raise rents. At the same time, three new apartment buildings near ISU's campus are weeks away from opening, a sign at least someone is making a buck. To sort it out, I spoke with landlords, developers, students, and Normal town officials about what led to the student apartment boom and why it may soon be over.
Morgan Anderson is a junior nursing major at Illinois State University. One of her dreams for senior year is to live at the Lodge, the massive apartment complex on Willow Street that, from the outside, looks like where multimillionaires would spend the night after going skiing.
Like, that would be so cool. But then again, like, reality kind of hits, but that's way too much money.
That's too pricey for Anderson, who works and has loans to pay her own way through school. Instead, she's in a more modest townhome with three other students, paying $615 a month. Even that's a stretch. When you ask Anderson about the Lodge, with its granite countertops, guest bathrooms, pools, hot tub, she doesn't sound resentful about not living there or the high rent.
I mean, it is expensive, but it's worth it to me, and I'm sure a lot of other people feel that way, too. Just to have your own place and be on your own, I don't know, a nice feeling.
The off-campus student housing business has changed drastically in the last decade, when ISU closed and then demolished two giant dorms and pushed 1,500 students into the private sector. Landlords, many of them developers themselves, have responded by building fancier and fancier apartments, trying to meet the demands of a modern college student.
That's continued this summer as builders put the finishing touches on three new apartment buildings surrounding ISU. The Summit on Dry Grove Street replaced two older buildings that had only four units each. Stadium suites will have 24 units, 84 beds, where a demolished gas station once stood across from ISU's Hancock Stadium. And the biggest project is the $18 million expansion of the Lodge, adding 263 beds to the 300 that were already there.
It's been like that year after year. Townwide, Normal has seen 59 new apartment buildings with over 1,000 units built over the last decade, many for ISU. 20 years ago, 40% of undergraduate ISU students lived on campus. Now it's about 31%. There are signs that the new construction boom may soon be over, including the possibility of more on-campus university housing at ISU. Andy Netzer is general manager and managing broker at Young America Realty, the largest student landlord in Normal.
With this project and a couple others, we're probably at saturation point where it's the supply and demand is probably shifted a little, and I think for the next couple of years you'll see not a lot of new construction coming on. And if we did more of this, we'd be creating our own vacancy.
I toured the Lodge construction site with Netzer a couple of weeks ago. He showed it off like a proud father. The units have one bathroom for each tenant, plus one for the guests. There are stainless steel appliances, granite counters, and stained cabinets in the kitchen. The nicest unit has a spacious balcony overlooking the pool and hot tub. Inside, an antler chandelier hangs from vaulted ceilings with exposed wood and track lighting.
We're expecting that some five-year-old in the suburbs of Chicago may be occupying this in 15 years. And what kind of expectations is that person going to have? For what kind of home did they grow up in? Did they have granite counters in their kitchen? Did they have their own bathroom? And I think as we see a trend line increasing of what students are used to and what they're expecting, we want to meet that market, not just for today, but for the future.
All that comes at a cost. Rent is between $700 and $1,000 a person. Netzer says it's the top of the market.
A lot of pricing, the Young America portfolio does look at, well, what's the pricing of the lodge, and everything then can kind of tier down from there.
Oh, okay, so the lodge is sort of a market setter in that respect.
Right. Nothing else on campus can probably expect to command higher rents than here. So, and nor can they increase rent over time. Could they increase rents if the lodge is not increasing rents? And if ever the lodge is decreasing rents, so they should take a hard look at decreasing their own rents.
Netzer says they're not having any problem finding students who want to pay that higher rent for more amenities. Quite the opposite. The new lodge, which is co-owned by Young America owner Ralph Endress, has been fully leased since October 2017.
We also see that the appetite for our most economy properties is falling. So when we hear people say there's just, you know, this lodge is incredible, but who can afford all that, and they're going to run out of affordable housing for people, we really don't see that problem. What we see is we've got too much of the affordable and not enough demand for it. So the softest part of our portfolio is the apartments with the least amenities, with four bedrooms and only one bathroom, with no dishwasher. And some of those can be modified, but we cannot very easily add bathrooms. And where we can, we have been. We're remodeling a building this summer also, and we have been, had a history of, you know, one or two buildings every summer, trying to add bathrooms where we can and overhaul them and bring them up in terms of amenities.
Morgan Anderson, the nursing major, is also the Secretary of College Affordability for ISU's Student Government Association. She says it's hard to find a nice place to live for less than $550 a month.
I think it's really overpriced. Just from my one townhome, they make like $2,400 a month every month. And like that's crazy because it's only a four-bedroom apartment. It's not like anything big or special. And I know people that pay rent, like not in a college town, it's so much cheaper and you can get so much more for your money.
Property owners say they're responding to demand. Ed Souter had owned the two apartment buildings on Dry Grove Street since the late 1970s. That's where the Summit is going up.
And they were probably built in the early 50s, maybe late 40s. And we were having a little harder time renting them. Their amenities were limited. The rooms were small. Bathrooms were antiquated. And we would have had to done a major rehab. Thousands and thousands of dollars. And we thought, do we want to put that kind of money into an old building that's kind of outdated and didn't look quite right? So then we elected to bite the bullet, tear them down, level the lot, and then start from scratch and build a new building.
That's how the Summit was born. The $4 million-plus building opens next month. It'll command higher rents, between $725 and $1,100, in part due to its proximity to campus. Its mountain theme, with stairwells named after Mount Everest and Denali, was inspired by Souter's own passion for the outdoors. So how did Souter know how to price the rents?
Extensive market research on what the vacancy rate is with various levels of apartments that have offer various services or various sizes and convenience. We see what's renting, what's not. I guess I just have to say it's something that's comes from experience.
The town of Normal sets certain parameters for new apartment construction, such as parking, setbacks, how tall it can be. But nothing in the town code is dictating that places like the lodge have to have a clubhouse with stone fireplaces, a leather couch, and a pool table.
And those are decisions, again, that are completely on the private side.
That's town planner Mercy Davison.
The expense level is tied to the amenities that are being provided on these properties that are far beyond what the code would require.
In addition to new construction, Normal has also seen many landlords embark on costly summer remodeling projects to make their older buildings more attractive to students. It's according to Greg Tremmel, inspections director for Normal. He says they're reworking kitchens and changing four-bedroom, one-bathroom units into three-bedroom, two-bathroom units with laundry.
They continually are modifying these units to try and avoid having a four-bedroom sit with just two people renting in it. So I give them a little bit of credit for trying to stay on top of that.
Davison says landlords are even sprucing up the exterior because they know that curb appeal is huge with parents.
A lot of parents are a lot more involved in where their students live than like back when we were in college, and my parents literally did not, they had nothing to do with my picking where I was going to live. But now you have parents that come through and they want to see something that looks attractive, that looks well maintained. And so, they want to have security. And that's not cheap, you know, to go reclad part of your building in brick. That's happened a couple times. Not the whole building, but they'll put some accents in, change out some windows, spruce up the landscaping. So that's all to the benefit of the whole community because it's great when things look better.
ISU has a good relationship with the major landlords. That's according to Levester Johnson, Vice President for Student Affairs at ISU. The biggest ones, by the way, are Young America, First Sight, and Sammy. Netzer says Young America has around 50% of market share with 4,600 beds. Still, Johnson says affordability remains a critical issue across higher education. For on-campus housing and dining, for which ISU controls the price, the university wants to offer competitive amenities that impress prospective and current students, like the new Watterson Towers Dining Center expansion.
So all of those things have to be considered and in the mix, but guess what? We have to provide it at an affordable type of rate. So definitely we are concerned about rate issues for on-campus housing, as well as what students are paying off-campus. There are some students who, at some point in their developmental process, you know what? They're done with staying on campus here, and they might want to live within the neighborhood. So we would want to make sure that that's affordable for them as well.
The foundation of the off-campus apartment boom is ISU's decision in the 2000s to decommission those older dorms, partly because it would have been too expensive to retrofit them with fire sprinklers, also to make room for a new student fitness center. Now there are signs ISU may reverse course and move toward more on-campus housing, starting with a study.
We have taken a look over the last year and a half, I believe, at where is our current housing stock, both existing facilities, and what might be missing within that mix.
That comes against a backdrop of strong enrollment and the possibility of more as Illinois' regional universities bleed students and ISU bolsters its own international recruitment. ISU requires freshmen and sophomores to live on campus, but today there's not enough room for everyone. Many sophomores, like Morgan Anderson was, get exemptions to live off campus their second year. Johnson says there are educational benefits of living on campus.
Oh, well, we definitely believe it plays directly into the retention of our students. Any longitudinal study that you will have within higher education definitely demonstrates that the more proximity students have to other campus resources, like number one is other upperclass students who know all the unwritten rules and policies and things in order to be successful within the collegiate environment, as well as then the number two reason, faculty having access to great faculty and advisors as to, you know, supporting them academically and otherwise. So the more proximity you have to those resources, the greater your retention rate is going to be on your campus. So residential campuses like Illinois State University's do extremely well when you have a critical mass of housing and bed space on campus or adjacent.
That new study found ISU lacks enough on-campus housing for sophomores. With the exception of the six-year-old Cardinal Court on Gregory Street, ISU's on-campus housing is mostly traditional shared dorm rooms and shared restrooms inside of towers. There are no apartment-style or pod-style with shared living space options. So does all this mean that ISU is moving toward more housing on campus?
Yeah, I think what we're going to do is we're going to take those recommendations seriously, have conversations again with senior administration within the institution, as well as our trustees, gain some feedback about maybe going to that next level of feasibility and seeing what would be a business plan for such. Where would such type of housing be?
There are several options for where it could be. ISU acquired the site of a now-shuttered Normal Fire Station on Adelaide Street in 2015, possibly to accommodate expansion at Cardinal Court. A ton of Normal officials have also heard rumblings about the now-vacant land east of Main Street near Avanti's, where the South Campus dorms stood until they were demolished in 2012. That would have major implications for local landlords. Here's Andy Netzer from Young America.
It's a concern. We watch that. I say to a lot of people that this is the world's simplest supply and demand economic loop. You just have the supply of students and the available off-campus beds, and it's a one-to-one translation.
There are parallels to 2010, when ISU announced it was building Cardinal Court. Landlord developers criticized ISU then, saying it backtracked on its plans to get out of the housing business. In reality, Cardinal Court only replaced around 900 of the beds that were lost by the dorm demolitions. Landlords just waged a very public fight over property taxes. Young America, First Sight, and other owners objected when Normal Township's assessor revalued 57 different apartments, raising their assessed values and therefore their property tax bills. Last year, they reached a deal with Unit 5, the largest beneficiary of those taxes, to resolve the dispute. But that agreement allows for reevaluation if ISU enrollment rises or falls by more than 1,100 students. Ed Sauter, the owner of the Summit, says it's still a good business to be in. He lives in Roanoke and is part owner of a John Deere equipment dealership. If something goes wrong at one of his investment properties in Normal, he knows about it right away. More control, he says, than if he'd sent his money to Wall Street.
It's just a slow a process of discipline, of making your payments, of renting, of doing maintenance. It's not a home run, but it's just a series of base hits.
That's developer Ed Sauter. Move-in begins at ISU the week of August 13th. That's just 3 weeks away. You can take a closer look at the student apartment business with two interactive graphics at our website, WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. Coming up in a bit, we preview next week's Bratz and Braggs fundraiser in downtown Bloomington. But first, one in every three women and one in every seven men will be domestically abused by a partner at some point in their lives. That's according to Sena Ajibing, the director of countering violence at Mid-Central Community Action. GLT's Mary Cullen spoke with Ajibing about local resources for survivors of domestic violence.
It's estimated that Domestic Violence Act occurs every 15 seconds somewhere in the United States. That figure translates to over 2.5 million victims a year, and 85% of those victims are females. Here in Bloomington Normal, we have the Neville House, which serves local domestic violence victims. Ajibang says in fiscal year 2018, the house served nearly 750 local residents.
When we have an individual call or I'm speaking to an individual, they will be able to describe the behavior to you. They will not say, I'm a domestic violence victim. A lot of victims would not just admit that they're victims because domestic violence doesn't happen to strangers. These are people you have a domestic relation. This is someone you know, someone you care about, whether it's a partner, a significant other, a dating partner, a roommate, a family member. So those are the individuals that mean a lot to you. So it's always really difficult to fathom that someone that you care about, that you know so well, and they know you very well, would be the ones to abuse you.
The process for a domestic violence victim, from what I've heard, is that it starts with a hotline call. Can you take me through the process that a domestic violence victim goes through?
You're absolutely right. The process starts with a hotline call, which is a 24-hour hotline, is, I would say, the entry point to survivors seeking services. We provide a variety, a comprehensive number of services in the community, which is more of a wraparound service, because domestic violence doesn't just either happen once or it's not just one presenting issue. There are usually other dynamics around it. So yes, individuals will call the hotline, which is also helps them with the confidentiality piece, because safety is very important to us, so they can call to get information. We have very trained advocates who will provide answers and any information, options, and walk them through what their needs are or their concerns are. So the first step is them calling the hotline. From there, the steps are different for everybody. Someone might call not really understanding what domestic violence is or what abuse is or what they're going through. So they might just call and we will go through information with them. Someone might call and safety is a great issue. So our option will be the Neville House or getting an order of protection. Some might call and we will do a safety assessment. Safety might not be an issue at that time. They would want to talk more with somebody for them to process what's going on and to find out the best option for them. So counseling will be one, support groups will be one, or if they're having questions about kids and what's affecting the kids, we have a youth advocate that does that. We provide those options to victims and they make decisions or pick the options that work for them.
you mentioned a safety assessment. Yeah. What exactly is that, and what do you determine after doing such an assessment?
We have an assessment that we call a lethality assessment, and it has different levels, and that's what we go through to determine the level of lethality. So the first level could be, has your partner, whether male or female, has he yelled at you before? Has he said any offensive words to you, whether in private or in public? Has he attacked your character or your behavior? Has he criticized you? That's the first level, which is the verbal piece. And then it goes with an escalation, which is a continuum, because that's what domestic violence is. It just doesn't happen with the physical. And we have verbal mental abuse, we have financial abuse, we have sexual abuse. And so we talk them through that lethality. The lethality, that's the level four, would be, does he have weapons? Has he threatened you with a weapon? Has he hit you? Has he strangled you? Has he threatened suicide? Has he threatened to kill you or kill himself? Those are the signs that we know would be a high lethality, where we would provide other options of, you know, the shelter, orders of protection, and, you know, and other heightened options.
When you are speaking with maybe someone who doesn't know whether or not they're a victim of domestic violence, how exactly do you educate them on the topic?
Financial abuse is a big one that either the community or individuals don't even realize that it's abuse. So we're able to educate them about, you know, if he's calling your job every time to track you, or saying you're cheating on the job, or being physically abusive so that you are not... you're so bruised that you can't go to work, and doing things consistently for you to lose your job, that's financial abuse, or taking your money. So we're able to talk them through different things for them to be able to kind of notice that that's not consistent with a healthy relationship. So what's a healthy relationship and what's not? And so we're able to provide all of that information, and at some point they get to recognize that that's not, you know, a healthy relationship.
You mentioned how domestic violence happens on somewhat of a spectrum.
Yes.
It can start with verbal abuse all the way up to physical abuse itself. So when it comes to someone who is coming in with something that's not threatening them in a physical sense, how do you go about counseling or approaching how to address that issue in that person's life?
And I mentioned earlier about being able to point out to them what a healthy relationship looks like. And I think that's where you start, because people grow up with, you know, with what they know and environments. You would have someone who has even experienced physical abuse, whether it's child abuse growing up and the yelling and all that, so normal growing up, that they would not see it as abuse. They would see it as very normal. And so it's important to provide them with the other perspective, which is the healthy perspective. And it's important for advocates and for us to be able to do that in such a way that you educate them. We also have materials. We have the power and control wheel. We have the equality wheel. So if we have someone in person, we're able to see that, those different materials, to see, oh, this is really interesting. Oh, using the children, that's actually abuse. Keeping the children from seeing a partner, that's power and control. So we're able to show that, and showing them what the healthy part looks like and how it should be and how they should feel as an individual, and just being a healthy individual, and what doesn't feel right. They start pointing out the behavior that looks not so consistent with that. One of the things that we don't do is give advice or judge or point out, oh yeah, he should do this, you should do this, because the dynamic of domestic violence, it's power and control. They've been told what to do so many times, and so what we don't do is repeat the same thing that would look controlling without even realizing that that's what. So we're very conscious and strategic about the way that we provide information.
When it comes to domestic violence, there's more than one person in the equation. There's the victim, and then there's the abuser themselves. Is there any service provided to that abuser?
Absolutely. We have services for offenders in our community. I would say that with our county domestic violence program, we're a victim service program, and so we provide services to victims. But we're also aware that there needs to be services for the offender. We have the AVERT, Collaborative Solutions Program, that's an agency in town. We have the Twin City Behavioral Health. We have Chestnut that provides offender groups, and we work very closely with them. We understand that both programs or both agencies, we recognize that the basis of addressing the domestic violence issue is keeping victims safe and holding offenders accountable.
MCCA has the Neville House, which is the domestic violence shelter for the residents here in Bloomington Normal. Can you talk about the services that Neville House provides?
The way that I describe our services is immediate safety on one spectrum. In the middle, we have a lot of supportive services, and then on the other spectrum is long-term healing. So when you look at immediate safety, we have the Neville House, which is a 24-hour emergency shelter. The location is confidential. That is a safety piece where if a family or an individual is fleeing, they would be able to seek that safe haven to be able to kind of figure out the next steps. We also provide orders of protection, which is also an immediate or emergency service. We have court advocates at the courthouse that would help with the order of protection paperwork. I have to stress they're not attorneys, they're advocates, and so they're able to do that. They provide them with all the different options and kind of educate them about the process and the hearing and accompany them to the court. It's tough enough to go through domestic violence, and then it's tough enough to navigate the court system. So having someone who is experienced and educated about that system and having that support going to court, it's really helpful to victims. We also have, on that spectrum is the long-term healing, we have a therapist that would provide counseling and therapy for our victims. We have children's services. The kids who have gone through, whether they've experienced it or they've seen some type of abuse, it's very important to us because the kids who are able to have some type of intervention or some services at an early age, they will grow up to be very productive adults, and 70% of those kids will be fine when they grow up if there's that type of intervention. Without that intervention, you're looking at kids growing up who are potential offenders and potential victims. And we've seen that. We've seen the cycle, the intergenerational cycle. So we take that very seriously, and we have a youth services advocate that will work with the parents and the kids. And as I said earlier, a victim will come in and would need just one of those services and be okay. A victim will come in and would need all of those services. And we serve both adults and children, and we serve men also. And that's a question that a lot of people ask about. We do a lot of training and presentations in the community because we believe that educating the community about domestic violence is also really important. When I go out and talk about domestic violence, and the first question I hear is, well, why didn't she leave? That tells me there's still that stigma about victim blaming, just like in sexual assault, where they would say, what was she wearing? So there's still that stigma about they must have done something wrong to deserve the abuse. And you have to keep talking about dynamics and the reason why individuals stay, because there are so many reasons why people stay in an abusive relationship. And when they're ready and with that support, they would leave. And so we think one of our huge focus with our program is to provide that public awareness and education so that individuals know that there are resources available if they should need help or if they know someone who's gone through that. They also need to know in the community that the victim hasn't done anything wrong and that it's important to hold offenders accountable. And our hotline number, I always throw it out there, is 309-827-7070. So as we said, that's usually the first entry point, which is a huge service we provide in the community.
Mary Collins spoke with Mid-Central Community Action's Director of Countering Violence, Sena Ajabang. Support for GLT comes from The Music Shop, helping student musicians of all skill levels sound their best by partnering with school band and orchestra programs throughout Central Illinois. Instrument rentals, sales, maintenance, and repair. Details at themusicshop.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org. And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Governor Bruce Rauner has tried to put some distance between himself and President Trump. The Illinois Politics Roundtable looks at how and why this is happening. Sean Crawford moderates the panel, composed of political scientist Chris Mooney from the University of Illinois Chicago, Manny Vinicky from WTTW Public TV in Chicago, and IPR State House reporter Brian Mackey, who says Rauner is doing damage control on the Russian hacking scandal.
The governor, not only does he not sidle up to President Trump, he rarely even says his name. Mm-hmm. He really goes out of his way to avoid any responding. He's said that he doesn't feel like he has to respond to national issues the way, you know, typically the president says something, reporters go ask other politicians what they think about it. The governor just often shuts down that line of commentary. So it was notable this week that he joined a lot of other Republicans who criticized President Trump's statements about the Russian President Vladimir Putin, at least his initial statements at that news conference in Helsinki, where the president seemed to accept Putin's denial of Russian election meddling. Rauner was pretty strong. He said, you know, we should not be, as we heard at the top of the show, we should not be defending the Russians. He called Putin a brutal dictator. So this is a fairly rare instance of the governor explicitly putting daylight between himself and President Trump.
Chris, is Donald Trump a problem for Bruce Rauner?
Yeah, well, I think he thinks it is. I think Rauner thinks it is because he can't quite figure out what to do about it. And I don't blame him because I don't know what I would do if I was in his position either. As Brian was saying, I mean, he pretended that he didn't exist for, you know, the first year or so of his presidency. And then this week we have this sort of whiplash thing going on where, on the one hand, he, as everybody else in the in the West, came out and disavowed Trump's actions at the Helsinki press conference, but then in the same week he was speaking with Vice President Pence on a couple of occasions. I think one in particular up in Schaumburg, where he introduced him as one of the greatest leaders in American history, which I think probably even made Mike Pence blush. He talked fondly about President Trump and so forth. And then he gets hit with this other thing, with Trump coming out and sticking his foot in his mouth. So, I mean, the problem really for the governor is he doesn't know. He's running down the middle, and he's got a problem on his left and his right. And the right is, you know, the sort of Jeannie Ives faction of the Republican Party. They're mad at him because he doesn't take on the mantle of the president and run. On the other hand, you know, Donald Trump lost by, okay, check me on this. What percentage points did he lose by in the state?
20 or so, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, if he tacks towards the president, he's running against the majority in the state. If he tacks away from the president, he's running against a big chunk of his base. And you've got Sam McCain over there getting ready to welcome those people in his direction. So the governor's got a problem there.
Amanda?
And that's where you see the governor. I mean, he sort of splits the baby, right? When he is asked about Trump, he's gotten a little better at it than initially when he flat out refused to say the president's name. At that appearance in Schaumburg in the Chicago suburbs, Rauner literally said, Mike Pence, along with President Trump, are doing it for every American right. Who knows if that'll make a commercial, but by and large, you don't hear him speaking the president's name ever. Instead, what he says is, when I have spoke out against the administration, I have done so strongly with Russia as an example, the immigration detention centers, for example. And then he says, but they're doing great things for the economy and tax cuts, and that's what I approve of. So he tries to bring some nuance into the discussion, but I'm not quite sure that voters will appreciate or pay much attention to that nuance, particularly if you look at the campaign that J.B. Pritzker is running, where I got to tell you, my inbox from the Pritzker campaign has little to no actual initiatives, proposals, stances on issues. I would say 99 out of 100 emails, and there's at least that many, by the way, are trying to connect Rauner to President Trump.
Well, Brian, Chris mentioned the fact, too, that it was a 20% roughly loss for Donald Trump in the state of Illinois. So Rauner has that problem from the start, and that he's basically running in a blue state, as we know, in Illinois. And yet probably I'm guessing that Donald Trump's approval ratings are down in the state of Illinois from election time. So, you know, how does he balance it out? Like you said, you're trying to run, you're trying to appease the right, but you've got all these people on the other side who are sitting there saying, how could you possibly work with Donald Trump? So, yeah, he's caught in the middle. This is I just don't know how he's going to work himself out of this.
Yeah, I mean, that's the challenge here. The president remains very popular. I just heard on Friday morning a report on NPR that the president's performance in the Russia summit had 80% approval among Republican voters. So there is a core element of the Republican Party that is really sticking with the president on this. And the question is, given Governor Rauner's tepid at best embrace of President Trump, given the fact that he supports abortion rights, given the fact that, you know, there was a report that he seemed to be officiating at a same-sex wedding ceremony earlier this summer, I mean, he has done a lot of things. And I should also mention that he signed a bill meant to protect undocumented immigrants here. So he has just done a lot of things that go against what the base likes, what they like about President Trump. He's also just in style. What makes the president, I think, popular among a lot of voters, what we hear is that he just tells it like it is. He seems like an authentic, real person, not like a focus grouped politician. And the governor is very much the opposite. He's very cautious. He's very considered in what he says. He often will repeat the same answer that, you know, seems to be a talking point, no doubt poll tested, focus grouped. So he certainly lacks that sort of from the hip style that President Trump brings as well. And as we've said, it's going to be a very tricky thing for him to navigate.
This is not the only race, the governor's race in the state of Illinois, that people are watching, though. We're watching a lot of congressional races, and at least a few of them are really in play this year. And apparently this week, after the Trump comments in Helsinki, we've actually seen some Republican congressmen who are in those tighter races who have basically came out and sort of broke with Trump on that issue. And that included Peter Roskam, that included Rodney Davis in central Illinois, and some others as well. So are we seeing something here as well, that these folks are trying to distance themselves from Trump?
I mean, carefully. I think it's this nuanced distance where, despite Brian, the report on NPR in terms of GOP approval, clearly there has been some poll testing to the opposite effect of here in Illinois, or particularly in those districts that could swing either way, and you have a lot of moderate voters, because both Rauner barely needed to be asked before he went off on Trump in such an unequivocal way the other day when he was denouncing the president's behavior in Helsinki. I mean, same with Peter Roskam. Not only did he come out against the president's actions, but, I mean, we, again, got press releases. He went on all of the radio shows and TV programs to talk about it. This is a message that they wanted voters to very much know. That said, when you listen to those interviews, the complaints are very much confined to the Russia situation. And beyond that, again, it goes back to praising Trump for taxes. And I think they're still trying to make sure that they don't sort of poke the bear. And that bear could be either the president himself, because very much, of course, you've seen the president go against anybody who speaks out against him, even if they're members of his own party in Congress, as well as the bear that could be their electorate.
Amanda Vinicky reports for Chicago Public Television. Along with her on the Illinois Politics Roundtable were political scientist Chris Mooney, IPR State House reporter Brian Mackey, and moderator Sean Crawford. This is Sound Ideas.
July is National Ice Cream Month. Yes, I scream, you scream, we all scream when the news gets out of control. All Things Considered helps keep things in perspective with news and sprinkles of the lighter stuff.
More pickle!
Oh, I've got some of the pastry on my microphone.
Listen to All Things Considered for news and scoops that are a little sweeter. Hear the bigger picture every afternoon.
I'm GLT All Things Considered host Mike McCurdy. Join me weekdays from 3 to 6 p.m. on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from ESA, Eye Surgical Associates, with Doctors Brownstone, Crockett, Pinter, and Vise, providing innovative treatment and vision-correcting surgeries for more than 30 years. Routine vision care also available. You can see the difference at eyesurgicalassociates.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Cornhole, beanbags, bags, it's all the same game, and sometimes gets a little cutthroat, even for amateurs. The annual Rotary Brats and Bags fundraiser is coming up Friday, August 3rd on the Museum Square in downtown Bloomington. GLT's Charlie Schlenker talked with Chris Downing, a co-chair of the event, now in its 11th year. With all that experience, it's perfected, right?
Perfect is strong, but we've consistently improved it, but there will be new things this year. We're expanding.
How?
So this year we'll have, in the past we only had 10 sets of bag areas to be played. This year will be expanded to 16, so that's more people who can participate. Allows the tournament to move a little bit faster, a little bit smoother. Also allows more teams to play, and you're not waiting as much because it's a double elimination tournament. We have about 100 to 110 teams that play every year, so we are really limited on our time, and there was a little bit of wait time that we saw before, but now that's going to open up quite a bit. This year we'll also feature White Oak Brewery will be our beverage provider. So whereas in the past we had a beer truck there that had your more standard venue that would be a nationally known brand, this now allows for a local brew to be experienced. There will be three different varieties.
And the brats.
We're cooking them up. We start cooking at 8 a.m. The brat lunch opens from 11 to 1. Down on the square, and so $8 a ticket there. You can purchase those online. You can purchase them day of if you so choose. You can purchase them from your favorite Rotarian with a club of over 130 people. Hopefully somebody you know is a Rotarian and will gladly sell you a ticket.
If you are a bags aficionado,
sure.
How cutthroat is this competition?
That's a great question. So it is, it's an amateur tournament. We say it as such, and I'm sure someone who is listening says, well, what's the difference between a professional and an amateur? There are both national and regional rankings of bags teams. And so we check, as people are registering, we check it against that regional ranking. And if you are regionally ranked, we do not consider you an amateur. So if you are quietly stalking and waiting to come win a tournament, ours isn't the one for you. Plus, it's also not as financially lucrative as other bags tournaments can be. This really is a fundraiser to support two really great local charities.
Which are?
They are the Boys and Girls Club and Midwest Food Bank. So Rotary really focuses on trying to and help and support children, whether it's either locally or internationally. And locally, we feel as though our partnership with the Boys and Girls Club really connects with kids who, with the proper support, end up being fantastic members of our community. And we're helping to give them that opportunity to build the skill set so they can be so. And the Midwest Food Bank is one of those priorities that we feel as though, as a Rotary club, that we're helping to really affect people's lives and make their existence here more sustainable.
Are those the two charities every year, or do you rotate?
They rotate. We each year try to take a look. It's a decision made by our Rotary executive board as well as the co-chairs of the event. Midwest Food Bank has been a partner of ours a number of years. There have been some where they weren't, but for the most part, we've been very supportive of that. The Boys and Girls Club continues to kind of grow as one of the charities that we end up supporting as well, too. So it rotates a little, but not much.
What have your results been like?
Consistently growing. Last year, our gross was over 20,000, so very healthy there in that sense. We hope to continue to grow that, or at least remain stable in that part of things. And so we're able to make a difference in each of the two charities that we support. We want to make sure we're making an impact. There have been other years where we've been, like I said, in kind of the mid-20s. For the past couple of years.
Where do the players come from? How wide an area?
So with us really kind of going with the amateur status, so it, again, as we talked about perfection, we we've now really kind of changed on that. So if you and I are having this conversation 4 years ago, we were seeing people coming from as far as Indiana, Wisconsin. We had, I remember one team 1 year came all the way from Missouri, but these were professional bags people, and they were showing up and winning games after three rotations that they were so good at it. They were throwing it into the hole every single time. And if it's you're an amateur that's stepping into it, you're getting knocked out quickly. And they were coming for the prize money. They were coming because that is what they did. And they came, you know, you would see guys in RVs parked two blocks away. They'd play theirs. They'd go back to their RV. They'd come back. They would have questions about whether these were perfectly weighted. You know, is this regulation? And we learned a lot from that and felt as though it wasn't the culture we were looking for within it, that as Rotarians, we're really focused on our community and wanting to interact with other people from our community. And so we reduced down where teams can come from. So it is now local. We give the general concept of McLean County as where a team should be coming from. But if you live in Champaign and you want to make the trip up just because you like playing bags, we're happy to work with you on that. But 95% of our teams are coming from the McLean County area.
Amateur, that does not mean unskilled, though.
Oh, very much so. That there are still amateur teams that are very good at what they do. They're very talented in that sense. And you see the difference. And that's, again, why it's double elimination. So we don't want it to be where, you know, you run into Charlie and his buddy and they just knock you out in three throws and you're done. You get to drop then. And if you run into that, you drop into the loser's bracket and you get to work your way back. And the final games, you see a set of gamesmanship, and it's interesting to watch how people pay attention to that.
Oh, okay. How do you get gamesmanship in a relatively simple game like
See?
This?
See? And right there, that is, it. Again, before I became involved with this, I would have had the same thought. It is where you are positioning your bag that if you're going to miss, you sometimes are trying to defensively build a wall, or you're trying to make it so that the person throwing against you has to make choices and decisions. Think of it the same way as you watch curling. The curling, oh, that's simple. You're sliding a rock down. But there's the idea of, all right, where do I set up maybe a defensive part? Or if I'm going to miss, I want to miss this way. Or, hey, I'm noticing that I'm getting an extra slide here. Or I know that the guy I'm playing against likes to slide it, so I'm going to try and drop one into a certain spot.
Is there trash talking in tournament bags?
It depends. It
really throwing some shade.
Yes, there's, and it happens in, with bags being such a Midwestern game, I believe the trash talking also comes forth in a Midwestern way. There's the, well, that was an interesting throw, or it is very, it's subtle, or you'll see, oh, okay. And it's maybe not as blunt or as direct or as mean as you would expect, but if you're listening, the barbs are there, the nuanced parts of it are there.
I see what you were going there yes. for there. Yes. Oh, too bad.
Yes. Yeah. That was a great attempt. Maybe next time.
And
it's that. And then there are others who, you know, they take it very seriously. And the weirder part is when they don't talk to you, that you're standing next to somebody, they're 2 feet away from you, and you're there. You know, some of the good games go for 10, 15, 20 minutes. I've seen people who don't even acknowledge that there is another human being, you know, 2 feet away from them. And then there are other guys and gals who are having entire conversations and, you know, and things like that. So to each their own.
Bags as spectator sport.
Fascinating. One of the fun things that I get to do is that the bags are lined up. And so you're able to look right down the middle and to watch the bags kind of arc back and forth. It is almost like a more simplified, almost water dance that you would maybe see at Las Vegas or something like that. They're just these blue and red bags on an arc making their way back and forth. And the subtle thuds that they make as they hit the boards. And as you have everybody playing, it becomes almost rhythmic. It has a almost like a feel of nature kind of part to it. So if you're looking at the tournament as a whole, it's very interesting. When it gets down to the final teams, you can feel when there's less to watch and there's only maybe eight teams playing or four teams playing, you get to see the investment and emotion that people have kind of put into it. They've been playing since 5:30 and it's 9:30, 10 o'clock. So, you know, you've been playing bags, not nonstop, but you've been there for 5 hours. You're an invested player and you can see it kind of come through. The brats lunch, we see over 1,000 people come down to have a brat. And again, I don't know if I'm part of a more Midwestern-y feel fundraiser that you're going to get anywhere else. That you hear about 5Ks, but those happen everywhere. You hear about golf outings. That's something that happens across the nation. But the idea of, hey, come have a brat and throw bags, I think you have to kind of be from our region to really truly appreciate and have that feel for it. And it's the other great part where people get to participate. If you're looking for a greater cross-section of society, I think this leads to that. You know, 5Ks, I think, are a fantastic fundraiser, but that brings a certain type of person and a certain type of athleticism. Golf, same way, brings a certain type of person and a certain type of focus. Bags is one of those that it's an easy sport to explain. If you want to call it a sport, it's here, you pick it up, you're trying to toss in that hole over there, and away we go. And it can be community building too. And it's fun. The earlier rounds, you'll see people kind of chatting it up. And I'm always impressed by the people who actually root for their competitors. Like, wow, that was a really good throw. And not in the shade backhand way, but just genuinely are enjoying the experience and shake hands afterwards and, you know, hug. And you're like, well, did you guys know each other? And they're like, no, you know, I just met them and they just seem like a nice person. So it can bring people together too.
Chris Downing is the co-chair of the Bloomington Normal Sunrise Rotary Brats and Bags Tournament. He spoke with Charlie Schlenker. More information is at bnsunriserotary.org. Lunches are $8. Bags are $50 if you register before the end of July. Brats and Bags is Friday, August 3rd. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Mary Cullen and Charlie Schlenker. WGLT.org is the first place to go to subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast. You can also check out Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet us your comments using the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. And I'm at Ryan WGLT. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.